But she actually has nothing to do with that monument. Cleopatra's needle is an obelisk, not from Cleopatra's time, but from that of an Egyptian pharaoh named Thutmose III. He commissioned this obelisk, this monument, and three others as well, in the year 1450 BC. And they were all to honor the sun god Ra. Now, they were carved from solid granite, and they were transported to the Temple of the Sun in the city of Heliopolis, near present-day Cairo. The centuries later, during the first century, the Romans moved these particular obelisks from the temple to the city of Alexandria, and they renamed it for Queen Cleopatra, who some of those Roman emperors were rather enamored with. And there it stood until 1881, when the Egyptian government gave it to the city of New York. And it was a goodwill gesture at the time. They were trying to improve the relations with the United States. Now, one of the important personalities of the Bible either likely saw this obelisk, or at least he knew about it. Thutmose III was known to Moses, and he played a part in Moses' life and in the events that led up to the Exodus. So with that introduction this morning, I'd like to spend some time that I have going into the events that occurred just prior to the Exodus, and in particular, those surrounding Moses himself. And we'll see that God gave him an important role to play in the Passover and Israel's subsequent Exodus from the land of Egypt. So let's look into the life of Moses. We don't have time to cover the entire story of Moses, but we're going to look at his early life and see how God prepared him for the responsibility that he would be given in just a short period of time. So let's start by seeing how God lays the groundwork for the fulfillment of his plan. We know that God says he'll do nothing unless he describes it first to his prophets. So if you would turn over to Genesis 15, and we're going to read some of the groundwork that God laid for what he was about to do in the centuries after Abraham. Genesis 15, and this conversation starts with God's desire to give Abraham a son, and then to make that son into a nation. Genesis 15, verse 1, "After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Abram, I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward.' But Abram said, 'Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?' Then Abram said, 'Look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir.'" Down to verse 5. "Then he brought him outside," God speaking, "and said, 'Look now toward the heaven and count the stars if you are able to number them.' And he said to them, 'So shall your descendants be.' And he believed in the Lord, and he counted it to him as for righteousness. Then he said to him, 'I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to inherit it.'" Down to verse 13. "Then he said to Abram, 'Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them for 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterwards they shall come out with great possessions. But in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete.'" So God let Abram know, later to be called Abraham, that he already had a plan that he was working on that included him having a son, but also growing a nation from that son. And he would work out the details over the next 400 years. We'll see that this would include a period of affliction for those descendants. And later, the removal of his people from that land and the judgment on that nation that actually would be afflicting them. Now, we know that this process began with the birth of Isaac, and it carried through for several generations. And finally, God saw fit to relocate Abraham's descendants to the land of Egypt. And he used Joseph and a worldwide famine to initiate that move into Egypt. So quickly move forward to the last chapter of Genesis, Genesis 50. And we'll see here that Joseph, speaking to his children about these same coming events, as Abraham had been told by God. Genesis 50 and verse 24. And Joseph said to his brethren, I am dying, but God will surely visit you and will bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. So Joseph knew what events, knew what God had told Abraham, and he recognized that the events of his life were actually a step in the fulfillment of that plan. So the Israelites had been relocated to Egypt, but they still were relatively few in number. They were given the land of Goshen to live in. Now, Goshen was a fertile portion of the Nile Delta in northeastern Egypt. And it was part of the alluvial plain from the Nile River. Now, go forward to Exodus 1, and we'll read Exodus 1, verse 6. And Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Now here's an important statement. This new Pharaoh comes on the scene, and he had no personal relationship with Joseph or the Israelites themselves. They originally had been welcomed into Egypt by the Pharaoh of Joseph's day. Certainly the memory of that apparently had faded, and these later rulers began to look on the Israelites as somewhat of a threat to their national sovereignty. Verse 9, and he said to his people, look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war that they join our enemies and fight against us and so go up out of the land. So they were worried about them on several fronts, one of them being that they might actually leave the land. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar and brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with vigor. Now, there's a lot of controversy about the veracity of the Bible in several different areas, and the time of the Exodus is one of these controversies. Many skeptics reject the Exodus outright, but others argue about when it might have actually occurred. So let's just spend a moment looking at some of the historical details that we know about this period in Israel's history, and in particular the line of pharaohs that ruled over Egypt as God brings this plan to fruition. And this is some important groundwork as we later go into Moses' life. Now, among those that accept the Bible, there is some basis in fact, but there's two main theories about what the time frame of the Exodus might have been. Because the Bible mentions the store cities of Pithom and Ramses we just read about, some scholars are placing the Exodus in the events of the 12th century B.C., when there was actually a pharaoh named Ramses. And if you recall the movie, The Ten Commandments, the pharaoh played by Yul Brynner is called Ramses. So but did the Exodus occur in the 12th century? Well, Ramses, actually it was Ramses II, ruled Egypt about 1250 B.C. Is that the correct time frame? Well, God doesn't give us the exact name of the pharaohs that we can pinpoint it, but he does give us some other clues. Notice what he's written in 1 Kings 6. You don't need to turn there, but this is written about the time of Solomon. 1 Kings 6, verse 1, and it came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. Now we know from history the date of the exact dates of Solomon's rule. He began in 970 B.C. So if we count forward and then to his fourth year, and then 480 years back, it would place the Exodus in the year 1446. And quite a few scholars do accept 1446 as the likely year of the Exodus. But this puts it in the 18th Egyptian dynasty, not the 19th in which Ramses lived. And among the pharaohs of the 18th dynasty were some names that we'll talk about in a few moments. Thutmose I, Thutmose II, Hatshepsut, and Amenhotep. Now we'll go further into the rule of these kings in just a few minutes. Now what would it have been like to live in Egypt? Egypt had been settled and established actually very shortly after the flood. The great pyramids that we still see today were already hundreds of years old when the Israelites moved into the land. And one characteristic of the Egyptians is that they were very religious. They imagined a very extensive spirit world that included just about every living thing. And as a result, there was a whole host of creatures that were sacred to them. Their gods included cats, hawks, ibises, bulls, dogs, just to name a few. And the people of Egypt lived in a very rigid social structure. The nation of India, just a couple of centuries ago, might have had somewhat of a similar makeup. In Egypt, the pharaoh was at the top and considered to be a god, with priests, government officials, tradesmen, and others all below him. And at the bottom were serfs and slaves. And people were born into their position, and they had almost no chance of moving up during their lifetime. So slavery and forced labor was a way of life for quite a few people in that time. Scientists still don't completely know how they built some of those massive structures like the pyramids, but they do know that it took a huge workforce of laborers, probably into the thousands. And many of them were working for decades on a single building project. And except for the upper echelons of society, there was very little respect for human life. Now, the pharaoh ruled by divine right, but most citizens had no rights whatsoever. And as time went on, these Israelites gradually fell into that bottom of this structured society. So with that as the backdrop, let's begin to look at how God began to fulfill his plan for Israel. And we're just going to read in Exodus that the Israelites began to be considered a threat. We just read that. So let's deal with their growing numbers Pharaoh decided to take drastic action. So if you were to turn to Exodus 1, and we'll start at verse 22. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, "Every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive." Now initially the midwives refused to assist with this governmental policy, but eventually Pharaoh must have had other agents who were looking for male children to kill them. Chapter 2 and verse 1. And a man of the house of Levi went and took his wife, a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. Now the word for beautiful means goodly or excellent. And he was special in some way, but we're not exactly told how. But obviously God saw some qualities in Moses that he would be able to use. Notice what Stephen says in Acts 7, verse 20. You don't need to turn there, but he gave a lecture, so to speak, to the Sadducees and Pharisees, and he mentioned this time frame. In Acts 7, 20, he says, "At this time Moses was born and was well-pleasing to God and was brought up in his father's house for 3 months." So it's clear that God, as a newborn, Moses was already known to God. The Jewish historian Josephus in the first century AD provided a commentary about much of the history of the Jews, and he included that about Moses. And according to his writings, God appeared to the father of Moses, which was Amram, in a dream. And he was told that his wife, whose name was Jehoshabed, that they would have a child. And he said this about the child, and this is what Josephus writes: "This child shall be concealed from those who watch to destroy him. His memory shall be famous while the world lasts, and not only among the Hebrews, but foreigners also." So he apparently, if we believe what Josephus said, actually spoke to Moses' parents, so they may have had some understanding of what God had in mind for him. Now Exodus 2 verse 3, "But when she," Moses' mother, "could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank." Now we might wonder what would possess a mother to do such a thing. But based on that revelation that was given to her husband, she would have had faith that God was already involved and would protect the child. Hebrews 11:23, you don't need to turn there, tells us this about her actions. Hebrews 11:23 says, "By faith Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born, because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict." Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, this is verse 5, and her maidens walked along the riverside, and when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maids to get it. So some commentaries have indicated that this area was near the palace, and they were actually inlets off of the Nile, and they were set up for religious ceremonies that the royal family would conduct. And there were actually barriers in these areas to protect from crocodiles and other dangers that might be in the water. Verse 6, "And when she saw it, she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him and said, 'This is one of the Hebrews' children.' Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, 'Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?' And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Go.' So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages.' So the woman took the child and nursed him." Now there's little doubt that she recognized Moses as an Israelite baby. But she wanted him despite the fact that her father had ordered all the male children to be killed. And we also see that Pharaoh must have accepted the child when he was brought into the household. And again, that's somewhat of a mystery, but God's hand obviously is in this. Now, we're not going to read the remainder of the account in Exodus, but again, I want to read a section out of the book of Acts, again, in Stephen's discussion. This is in Acts 7, verse 21. "But when he was set out, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deed." Now, if Moses had stayed in his Israelite family, he would have known slavery and he would have known poverty. But as a child of the royal family, his education would have been rather extensive. With all the other children from noble families, he would have been taught about mathematics, about science, architecture, construction, and the arts as well. It would have included instruction about the pantheon of Egyptian gods that we just mentioned. As a royal child, he also would have been trained to enter into public service. That is, at some point, they would have expected him to rule in some capacity. Now, we just read Acts 7:22 that said he was mighty in words and deed. And do we have any evidence of that? Well, again, we have the writings of the Jewish historian Josephus. He says that in a time of crisis, Moses was actually given command of the Egyptian army. Ethiopia, the nation on Egypt's southern border, had attacked the nation and won several decisive victories in the southern part of Egypt. In fact, at one point from Josephus' description, it appeared that Egypt was actually in danger of going into total defeat. But Moses led the army in a counter-offensive, and he chose to go an inland route, which is rather dangerous and rather unexpected, rather than down the Nile, as would have been predicted by his enemies. And listen to what Joseph writes about this military campaign. "When he had therefore proceeded thus on his journey, he came upon the Ethiopians before they expected him, and joining battle with them, he beat them and deprived them of the hopes they had of success against the Egyptians. And he went on in overthrowing their cities, and indeed made a great slaughter of these Ethiopians. Now when the Egyptian army had once tasted of this prosperous success by the means of Moses, they did not slacken their diligence, insomuch that the Ethiopians themselves were in danger of being reduced to slavery and all sorts of destruction. And at length they retired to Saba, which was the royal city of Ethiopia." Now Josephus goes on to say that to avoid complete defeat, the princess of the Ethiopians offered herself in marriage to Moses, and by this marriage the war came to an end. Now, besides being a general, there's also evidence in other places that Moses may have been an architect. And in fact, some of the buildings that were erected during the reign of Hatshepsut, they may actually have been built and designed by Moses himself. Now, contrary to what the Ten Commandments movie showed, Moses appeared to be completely aware of his heritage. He knew he was an Israelite. He probably had some contact with his birth parents as he grew up. They surely would have told him about his family's history. And so at age 40, Moses' life took a rather drastic change. Turn again to Exodus chapter 2, and we'll pick up in verse 11. Now it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Now Luke in the book of Acts adds a few details to this story. Again, we're back in the book of Acts when we're once again reading what Stephen said before the Pharisees. And in Acts 7:23, he says, "When he, speaking of Moses, was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian." Verse 25, "For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand." So why would Moses have thought that? Why would the Israelites think that Moses was going to deliver them? Well, because they probably knew that he was high placed in Pharaoh's court. That might have been one reason. But what would have made Moses think that he was the one that was going to fulfill the promises that God had given to Abraham those centuries earlier? Well, again, Josephus can give us a clue. Earlier, I didn't read the entire account about the prophecy that supposedly was given to Moses' father. I left out one important statement, and here it is that kind of impacts upon how Moses might have been thinking. Josephus adds, "This child of thine, and shall be conceived, sealed from those who watch to destroy him. And when he is brought up in a surprising way, he shall deliver the Hebrew nation from the distress they are under from the Egyptians." So Moses probably expected that the Israelites would be looking to him for deliverance. He probably believed that as the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter, God would certainly have brought him to the throne for that very reason. It would have been easy for him in that position to have fulfilled God's plan. After all, hadn't God already placed Joseph a few centuries earlier just into the second highest position in the land of Egypt? But if that's what Moses was thinking, we know that that's not what God intended at that time. And things certainly took a totally different turn for Moses. Exodus 2 verse 13, "And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to one of them, to the one who did the wrong, 'Why are you striking your companion?' Then he said, 'Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?' So Moses feared and said, 'Surely this thing is known.'" So Moses must have thought at this point that he was conducting a rather heroic act to have killed this Egyptian, but instead he was viewed for what he was, simply the murder of a government official. It's likely there had always been a question in the royal family of exactly where Moses would have fit in. From what is believed to be the correct record of the pharaohs, his adopted mother's name would have been Hatshepsut. But she didn't marry initially, but later she married a man named who took the name Thutmose II. And she didn't have any children, but he had a child by a secondary wife. That was allowed quite a bit back in those days. And this son eventually became Thutmose III. And Moses would have been a rival to him had he stayed in Egypt. But when Moses killed this Egyptian, there was no longer any question about where Moses' true loyalty would have lied. There was no question about whether he could be in line for the throne since he had committed this act. So Moses recognized that he had no choice but to immediately flee from Egypt. So this concludes the first 40 years of Moses' life. He was born into slavery. He became one of the most famous and admired men of Egypt. Then at the end, he had to flee for his life. And in between, he had been a very accomplished man, but at this point, he was simply a murderer. Now turn to Hebrews 11 in the New Testament, Hebrews 11, the faith chapter. And we're going to read a few additional details that Paul gives about Moses. Hebrews 11, And we'll start in verse 24. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the approach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked for a reward. To the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. So Moses is listed as part of the faith chapter, but are these verses describing the stage of life that Moses was in at age 40 when he fled Egypt? Well, at that point, we don't have any evidence that he refused to be called the son of the queen. In verse 26 says he was esteemed. He esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasure in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. Well, at the time he fled, there's no indication that he even knew who God was. In verse 27 of that chapter said, by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. So is this true at the time that Moses fled? I think we'd actually have to say no. It seems that he left Egypt because he did fear the wrath of the king. So what we read here in Hebrews is certainly true, but it may not describe Moses at this stage in his life. So 40 years, the first third of Moses' life has passed. He's been taught lessons, but unfortunately, many were not the ones that God needed him to have learned. Now I'm going to, as I was preparing this morning, I thought of a dialogue from the movie, and I thought he kind of fit in here. There's not a lot of information in the Exodus about the period of Moses fleeing to Midian, but it's interesting that in the movie there's a dialogue that's offered, and I thought it kind of fit a little bit, so I'm just going to read a couple sentences from it. This dialogue was added by Cecil B. DeMille, who was a famous movie maker, and he added this as Moses was actually fleeing across the sands to Midian. And he writes, into the blistering wilderness, this man who walked with kings now walks alone. Torn from the pinnacle of royal power, stripped of all rank and earthly wealth, a forsaken man without a country and without a hope, his soul in turmoil. He is driven onward through the burning crucible of desert, where holy men and prophets are cleansed and purged for God's great purpose, until at last, at the end of human strength, beaten into the dust from which he came, the metal is ready for the maker's hand. Now certainly that was just written for a dramatic effect in the movie, but I thought it actually may have had some relevance to what Moses might have been thinking as he plodded across the desert to reach the land of Midian. So I mentioned he did flee to Midian. Why was it he fled there? Well, perhaps he thought that was out of the reach of the Pharaoh and the agents that he might have sent after Moses. But we'll see that God probably had a hand in this as well. Back to Exodus 2, we're going to pick up in verse 15. Exodus 2, verse 15. But when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered the flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, how is it that you have come so soon today? And they said, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and also drew water enough for us, and watered the flock. And he said to his daughters, where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him, that he might eat bread. And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter. Well, a couple of points about that. First of all, where is Midian? Well, it's generally understood to be on the east side of the Sinai Desert, across from what is now Saudi Arabia. And the Midianites actually were descended from Abraham through his second wife. You may not remember his second wife, but her name was Keturah. And who was this man named Reuel? Well, just a few verses earlier in chapter 3, he's also called Jethro. And one of the names might be a title rather than his name. And in that verse, he's called a priest. Now, there's no indication that he was a pagan priest. He probably knew a little bit about God, especially since his people were descended from Abraham. And later in chapter 18 of Exodus, Jethro makes several statements that rejoices about what God has done. That's later on in the Exodus story. And at one point he actually offers sacrifices. And he's also shown to have a good measure of wisdom when he advises Moses about how to administer justice over the people of Israel. In that chapter, Moses and the elders of Israel show this man Jethro very great respect. So even though he may not have known a lot about God, we simply don't know for sure, nevertheless, it appears he was a man of very high character who was widely respected among all of his people. Now, he would have been a totally different example from Moses to observe. He and his people lived very simply, making a living from the land, but it wasn't a land that had a lot of bounty like the land of Egypt had. Moses would not have observed a caste system among these people. They might have been relegated to relative poverty because of where they lived, but nevertheless, they respected each other. If you recall the movie The Ten Commandments, there's a scene in which Zipporah describes the kind of life that she and her people lived, and it may have been one of the more accurate moments of that movie. And she simply said that they lived as a very simple people. Picking up in Exodus 2, verse 22, "And she, Zipporah, bore him, Moses, a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a strange land. And it came to pass in the process of time that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up to God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groanings, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and he had respect unto them." Now this king that died was probably Thutmose III. He's the same one that actually commissioned that obelisk that we just mentioned about being in New York City. He came to power with King Hatshepsut after Moses had fled. And his death was probably about 1450 BC. Now the ancient record seems to indicate that Hatshepsut actually ruled over Egypt for a time as a pharaoh. And if so, her husband probably was in very poor health. However, at some point, this stepson, Thutmose III, came of age, and she probably was removed from the throne. In fact, not only was she removed from power, but there's almost every monument and record of her reign as pharaoh was also blotted out. And it's ironic that in the movie there's a statement that every monument, every obelisk, and other permanent records of Moses was to be removed. And that probably was true, but it also was true about his stepmother who rescued him from the Nile. And there's only a very few records that have been found that verify who she was and that she did actually reign as a pharaoh for many years. Now, following Thutmose III, another king comes on the scene, and history shows him to be Amenhotep II. He's the one that Moses will deal with. Now, we're going to pick up again with Moses in Exodus 3. It's now been almost 40 years since he fled Egypt, and probably any thoughts that he had about what he thought he might be doing on God's behalf for the Israelites has long ago faded. Chapter 3, verse 1, "Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of the bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why this bush does not burn. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for this place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God." So this is the first contact that the Bible shows that Moses actually had with God. He may, as we said, probably was taught by his mother and father about the promise that God made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and also of Joseph. But now he finds himself in God's presence. He's now about 80 years old. Verse 7, and the Lord said, surely I have seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt. And I have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the land of the Egyptians, who are in I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them up from that land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me. I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. So this prophecy that may have been given to his parents, spoken of by Josephus, may have come to mind. 40 years earlier, he may have thought that God was going to use him in his position in the royal house to bring the people out. But now God shows that he's going to do it in his own way. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? So he said, I will certainly be with you, and this shall be a sign that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Then Moses said to God, indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Moreover, God said to Moses, you shall say to the children of Israel, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my name to all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me, saying, I have surely visited you and seen what is done to you in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, to a land flowing with milk and honey. Then they will heed your voice, and you shall come, you and the elders of Israel, to the king of Egypt, and you shall say to them, the Lord God of the Hebrews has met with us, and now please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I am sure that that king of Egypt will not let you go, no, not even by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt, and all my wonders which I will do in its midst, and after he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be, when you go, you shall not go empty-handed. Now back when he was 40, Moses had been ready to act on his own. But what a change has taken place in this 40 years since Moses had left Egypt. He's no longer a brash man. A man who was willing to kill an Egyptian, and he was no longer filled with self-confidence. The quality of meekness has begun to be part of his character, and that's a quality that God can work with. Chapter 4 and verse 10, you'll turn over to chapter 4, verse 10. Then Moses said to the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither before nor since you have spoken to your servants, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. So the Lord said to him, who has made man's mouth? Or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Have not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth, and teach you what you shall say. And he said, O my Lord, please send by the hand of someone else, whomever else you may send. So initially Moses resists God, not believing that he can succeed. But eventually he submits to God's will, and we go down to verse 18. So Moses went and returned to Jethro his father-in-law and said to him, please let me go and return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see whether they are still alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. And the Lord said to Moses in Midian, go, return to Egypt, for all the men who sought your life are dead. Then Moses took his wife and his sons and set them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the rod of God in his hand. So we're going to conclude with the events of Moses' life at that point. There's still a lot more to cover, but obviously because of time, we certainly can't go into the other part of Moses' life. So what lessons can we take from these first opening four chapters of Exodus? Well, the first lesson I have is God takes a long view when he works out his plan. We see in this case that he spoke to Abraham almost 400 years earlier about what he would do. The children of Israel spent centuries in the land of Egypt. How does this impact us? Well, as God's church, we're also waiting for us to be delivered at the return of Jesus Christ. Not only are we suffering, but this whole world is suffering under sin. The land of Egypt in this story represents sin. And he did at that time, as he did at that time, God is himself waiting for the time that is right to execute deliverance for this entire world. He used the deliverance of the Exodus and specifically the Passover to initiate his plan of salvation for all of mankind. It started with these symbolic events that occurred here in ancient Egypt. God will complete his plan when he knows the time is right. Not when we think it's time, but when God determines it is the right time. Now the second lesson that I have is God is patient in working with us as individuals. At 40 years of age, Moses had already accomplished a lot. He had been a successful general. He was trained and educated in the court of the king. He was skillful in many ways of the world. But they were not the ways that God can use. God was willing to patiently wait another 40 years for Moses to develop the right frame of mind. He needed a humble and a meek man that he could lead. So at age 80, Moses was finally close to having that attitude. He wasn't yet perfect, but he was teachable, and he was willing to submit to God. So we've read this morning about Moses' early life and the condition that the Israelites found themselves in. At the end of the chapter 4, they're in a desperate physical and spiritual condition as well. When God called us, we were in the same sinful condition, living in a spiritual Egypt. So as we approach the spring holy day season, just about 6 weeks away now, if you haven't already, I urge you to begin to read the book of Exodus. We need to start spiritually preparing ourselves for the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. In these days, God shows us that he would deliver all mankind through his plan out of sin.